Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com.
Hi, David. Thank you for being on the Fundraising Talent Podcast with me today. You and I have gotten to know each other a little bit since the since COVID-19. One of us reached out to the other one, and we decided we'd engage, and we had some conversations a couple of weeks ago, and then I asked you to be my guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. So here you are. Before we start our conversation, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
And happy to do that. And yes, definitely. And Jason, thanks so much for letting me be here today. So that's a fun opportunity to be part of your show today. So I usually introduce myself as a recovering lawyer. That probably, you know, that bears a lot of baggage with it. And that's definitely more than a 12-step program there to recover from that. But, right. Recovering lawyer turned plan giving officer turned major gift officer turned fundraising consultant is sort of the sort of nutshell evolution of sort of where I've come from. I have a daughter who's a speaker and an author, and she likes to, you know, when folks like, you know, what's your dad do? And she'll tell them I'm a lawyer, but she says that I use my powers for good and not for evil, something like that. So
that's right. So David, you live in sunny Southern California, and you're the only person on the podcast in the sort of most recent. I think I had a California person on the podcast before the whole COVID-19 sort of thing became a reality for us. But before we dive into our list of myths, tell me about what COVID-19 looks like in Southern California.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looked like a lockdown, you know, situation, which is actually starting to change even in the last 24 hours. Today marks the day that in LA County, some of the, you know, sort of restrictions start to get lifted a little bit as to super special retail. And, you know, and of course, there's still social distancing and you have to wear masks and all those things with it and stay six feet apart. But it was pretty locked down. The media is crazy, right? I'm allowed to say that. Can I say the media is crazy? So,
you know,
the beginning of the time, so there's like one guy who was like arrested for whatever, paddleboarding or something. I don't know what he was doing. And, whatever, just do what you're told and, you know, you'll be all right. And, you know, and if you're asked in the middle of doing something, you know, modify what you're doing. But, it hasn't felt like, you know, prison or anything like that, but it's been definitely different here. But you definitely feel everybody's kind of done with it thing going on out there, which I think is how do we balance, you know, being responsible and at the same time, and what does that mean? Responsible as it relates to the economy and the folks that are getting hurt in other ways and the health piece and the economic piece. So it's a complicated thing, but, like I said, I'm glad we're starting to open up a little bit more, you know, as of today. We'll see, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to be in central Pennsylvania right now in the mid-Atlantic where it's wet and dreary and we're still in relatively still lockdown state, but it's a completely another to be like where you're at and think, man, I don't know that I'd want to be told that I couldn't go to the beach or something. So, yeah. David, you and I agreed that we would talk about, and I'm going to really let you tee this up, but I'm going to follow your lead. Sounds like you got some great stories that I think my listeners will be delighted to hear. We're going to talk about three myths. And I'm guessing that these myths are particularly relevant in sort of the current sort of climate that fundraising professionals find themselves. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. I came up with kind of three myths that I thought we could talk about today. If we get through all of them, you know, two of them are for sure right on. And then one is, you know, I think an evergreen thing for us to talk about.
Okay.
But definitely.
Yeah. Let's throw the first one out there.
Well, and the first, and this has just been interesting to watch, you know, the evolution of, you know, all of the thought leaders, some of them, which are friends of mine and yours, both, you know, out there in the field. And it's this, like, should I be asking now? And it just seemed like a lot of the noise and instruction and advice out there was like really one-sided. It was either, you know, yes, be aggressive and be out there, or it was like, no, you should be invisible and not, you know, and it's like that. That just was like at the, on the surface, the answer. So should I be asking now? And you got these two sort of countered positions. Yeah. Yes. Be aggressive and out there, and no, be invisible. So you're not, you know, tone deaf or whatever. So, and you know, I just think this, you know, fundraising is not rocket science, thankfully, because I'm not a rocket scientist, you know, merely a lawyer, but it's also not that complicated, right? Like it's heavily relational, but it is also heavily intentional. It can't be, you know, reaction. And I feel like that there was a disservice maybe in our sector where it was like, yes, be aggressive and go, and, you know, no, be invisible. And I didn't think either of those answers were, you know, I think they're both myths, and maybe not the best advice.
I have to say, David, so I was thinking about this last night because I knew you and I were going to be talking about this. And I have to say, I've heard more of the former. The, you know, when I'm sort of scrolling through social media, because we're all on LinkedIn or something. And right. And when I'm sort of scrolling through this stuff, it's like every fundraising guru on the planet is saying, yes, you should be asking. And I'm thinking, man, if we can't at least think a little bit more critically about what we're doing, and all we're basically saying is the same mantra, are we really instilling in the minds of our clients the idea that fundraising really isn't just always asking? And the answer from every fundraising guru out there, every fundraising expert or who thinks they're an expert, shouldn't necessarily just be this, yes, ask. I tend to think, and I think this is what you and I talked about offline last time we talked, is that we have got to be able to think more critically and maybe think more along the lines of how we should be asking. It seems to me like there should be asking going on right now, but if you're doing it in inappropriate and less timely ways, asking's not helping you. And I don't see anybody answering the how question. Yeah. Just last night, I saw a guy who's very well respected in our space, somebody who the majority of us would know, but his message out there is ask, but he doesn't tell you how to ask.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I even alluded to this, but I didn't say it. Like, you know, that answer depends on what you're asking for and from whom you're asking. And that kind of gets to the how are you going to ask, right?
Yeah.
I mean, early out of the gate, we put a chart together for our clients. And I don't know that I'm 100% into the chart now, you know, because whatever, 58 days have gone by. Actually, I heard that on a Zoom talk last night. And actually, some of my family was with me, and they're like, who's counting? Like, we're actually not counting in our house. I don't know. Maybe you're counting in your house. So I didn't know it'd been 58 days because I probably don't care enough to count. But
I can tell that it's been 58 days by the number of times I get on Zoom and have to wear my ball cap to hide the amount of hair under my head. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, you know, we started originally, we would ask our clients, you know, are you a crisis-related service provider? like, because this goes back to that being a little more critical, right? So like, well, what do you do, you know? And that's broader. So, you know, you can be into health, you could be into, you know, some sort of equipping. It could be like financial and economic, it could be emotional, it could be hope, like whatever it is that you're doing, you know, that's a life change thing. So crisis related service provider sounds, you know, harsh, but, you know, I think it is broader than it sounds. And then we were sort of like, well, you know, if you're a crisis related service provider, then I think, yes, you've got a lot more freedom, both on how and when and who you ask. And I think for mass appeals, Because in my mind, this was actually the thing that was missing. Like, because I'm a major gift officer at heart, right? That's what I do. So I'm, yeah. I'm not the, the book sale, bake sale guy. I'm the $1 million guy, right? Like that's what we do. Yep. So, but in the mass appeal world, which we do, we actually still help with, and we do a lot of online giving things here at Giving Design. But for mass appeals, I'm like, yeah, oh yes, if you're a crisis related service provider, yes, there should be mass appeals. They should have some high impact stories, and it should still be, you should still make sure you're not tone deaf. You should make sure you're not desperate, like things that are turnoffs, especially to more major gift folks. And then, if it's a major gift thing versus a mass appeal, major gift thing is probably going to be more one-on-one. It's going to need to be more strategic. And, we were telling our clients early on, rewind, 50, we'll say 50 days of the last 58, to start with your private foundations. And we saw at the same time we were telling our clients to start with private foundations, the Council on Foundations is putting together this list of, national and regional and local private foundations that are specifically addressing COVID-related things and, sustainability things for nonprofits in the light of that. So I thought, so that's good advice. So we're telling them to do that. Council on Foundations doing that too. And then we actually said to focus on your donor advice fund donors too, because like that's not coming out of their pocket, when there's the beginning of this economic uncertainty, we don't know where this is going to go. We don't know how long it's going to be. Donor advice fund folks have already put money there. They've already contributed it, right? They already got their deduction. It's sitting there. And if they've already been giving to you, it's a good chance they could give to again, especially if, what you're doing is directly related to some felt need being caused by this crisis. So that was sort of like our first piece. And then everybody else, because, not everybody we work with are, into like health equipment, financial, emotional. They're not all exactly crisis related service providers. So for us earlier, the mass appeal question, maybe, we need to think about it. We thought timing was everything. Messaging is everything. I think you wanted to make sure if you could be relevant in, the crisis, you should do it, but you shouldn't like stretch it. Like it shouldn't, people shouldn't like roll their eyes, if they got your mass appeal. And then on the major gift side, and I like this is where even some of the how starts really, I think, get some legs. So, if you've got a major gift prospect, and this is all about knowing people, right? Like you have to actually, you've had to have done some, stewarding along the way and had some engagement along the way, stuff that we'll talk about as we go here. So you'd know the person, right? And you would know if they're sustainability motivated and if they're like an optimist, right? And if like, market pressure wouldn't be a thing that would get to them. So if they're either of those things, then I think you could approach them for a major gift, because there is sustainability risk for some nonprofits in this. So if you've got a major gift donor that's motivated by that, and there are, an optimist, I would say go for it. The other side of the optimist thing is if they're stressed by market fluctuation, and I know some major gift donors that are that, lots and lots of zeros after their wealth, score. And, but the market thing, kind of undoes them a little bit. And then I'd be like, I'm not going to go ask them right now, but I'm going to check on them, because I know this may be difficult. So I just, that was sort of where I was coming down. I was just like, well, what are we asking? Who are we asking? Then how are we doing it? And sort of any segmentation along the way, and then based on things we know about folks. So I guess that's why we don't see that in soundbite form, because you can't deliver that in a soundbite,
I don't know if it's David. I don't know if it's soundbite. I don't know if it's because I tend to be a little more pessimistic about the way that some of our colleagues in the consulting ranks do what they do. And I don't think it's just because it doesn't fit in a quick, soundbite. I think what they're doing is they're hiding behind the reality that most of them who are saying keep raising money or keep asking are invested in methods that are not timely and appropriate right now.
Right.
For example, doing mass donor acquisition, new donor. I'm trying to get it all in the same word. I mean, but we all know what it is. It's, putting out an appeal to large number of non-donors now that is generally only going to break even at best. And in many cases, we design it and we've been selling it to our clients for decades on the notion that it even loses money sometimes, doesn't seem to me a timely and appropriate way to be at raising money right now. Because do you really want to be losing money
with donors that are not anywhere close to, I mean, couldn't you wait 6 months to acquire a donor that's not going to pay for themselves in the near term anyway?
Exactly. That's exactly. That makes way too much sense, though. You know,
but part of what I think I think this is what I'm trying to do with this podcast and with a lot of my communications is I think we have to raise the bar on those of us who are doing this sort of consulting work, because I think in many ways we're sort of the guardians of what it means to be, you know, really good at fundraising. And I think we're hiding behind things like only telling people, yes, go ask, when in fact we need to be thinking a little more critically. I think, and we need fundraisers out there who are enlisting advisors like ourselves, who are more discerning of what the advice, where the biases in the advice that they're getting.
Right. No, I agree 100% with that. Like I said, that's sort of why I even pitched this as a myth, because it just seemed like it was so one-sided, you know, kind of both ways. But definitely, as you said, the kind of leaning toward, yes, be out there and with this aggressive tone. And I was like, I actually don't like having an aggressive tone ever, you know, I don't know. And then that doesn't work with me. And I know I'm not, you know,
For two major gift types. I mean, you and I are both major gift guys. And so that's, you know, we know because of the work, you know, we know from the sort of the world we exist in and the way we see the world, we don't even ask that question. I don't know that major gift guys or gals, I don't know that major gift people actually even ever come to a place where they ask that question. Because they're not always asking. I remember the Curious Chameleon study that we were all somewhat fascinated with, I don't know, five or six years ago. And one of the characteristics of a really good fundraiser was was what they called strategic solicitation. And that was all about sort of not playing checkers, but playing chess. And knowing that, you know, asking wasn't necessarily, you know, an ask every time you engaged with the donor wasn't necessarily a timely time to ask.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And just being completely aware, you know, like I think this, you know, I heard some folks talk about, you know, on the be invisible side, wanting to make sure folks weren't tone deaf of the situation. And, you know, my thought is I don't want people to be tone deaf, you know, ever, you know, I want you to be like engaged enough and intentional enough that you're, you know, if you ever do come off tone deaf, it was completely something you couldn't have avoided.
Yeah, you're going to have to help me with that, because I haven't seen that advice. So where is that? That sounds like way off in left field or something, some weirdo or something. Who is telling people? I'm riding the fence too much here, but who's actually telling people not to ask?
No, I've seen it out there. Like, again, probably not to the extent of the aggressive piece, but there was definitely some folks that were like, you know, you need to sit on your hands. And I was like, how about sitting on my hands?
Talk about making yourself completely unnecessary and irrelevant and diminishing your value and all that stuff at a time when, you know, you do want to be valuable to your employer and to your client and whomever, you know.
I mean, I saw the whole thing from the beginning. I was like, this is such a great, you know, I talk a lot about empathy in stewardship because that's like a missing piece. And I was like, this is such, and I'll have folks like, well, I don't know how to be empathetic. You know, like, I don't know enough about them. I'm like, well, that's step one, right? You're like, you have to get to know them in order to be empathetic. But when you're in a common experience, especially in a common crisis experience, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know what to be empathetic about, right? Like it's around and impacting everybody. So, you know, just phone calls to check on people to see how they're doing. And then if you've been doing this long in the way, especially on the major gift side, you probably know if they have kids in college, you can actually ask, you know, did Sally have to come home or, you know, is she doing distance stuff? And just all of those things that come with the hard work of really of true, you know, relationship building, true getting to know people is what you could have. That's what you should have been doing. That's what everybody should have been doing this time. It's such a missed opportunity. If you haven't talked to a donor, you know, at all during this time, then that's like crazy. That's a huge missed opportunity from just being human, you know.
Well, it reminds me, and I'll get off my soapbox that you helped me prop myself up on here, but and we'll move on to your next myth. But it reminds me of something that I've said to a number of people recently, and that is the idea that fundraising has got to realize that everything we do is not about fundraising expertise, and that sometimes what an advisor like yourself or myself coming to the table is actually doing is helping them think about other things that are not really fundraising per se. And so, for example, in our firm, we talk a lot about organizational design and what it means to design an organization where any sort of activity, be it fundraising or anything else, can sort of thrive in. And so if you haven't addressed that, is necessarily addressing fundraising as a function of that organization even going to matter? And likewise, the idea of professional development, I think we've got professional development so classrooms and breakout sessions and training, when in fact, I think a lot of the professional development that really matters in fundraising is more like on the, it's like actually being on the field. It's learning by doing and not learning by what you can read in a textbook. And I think that's some of the stuff that I think our consulting peers sort of are missing out on. Is the opportunity to maybe be diversifying our own skills as we diversify the skills of our clients.
Right. Right.
So what's right. What's the next myth? I'll come down off my soapbox. What's the next myth?
No, that's all right. And this is the one that's sort of universal. Like this is like both, during a COVID-19 time as well as, any time. And yeah. It's the, we need more data myth. So,
you're just going to try to get me in trouble twice. I'm just going to have to hop. Okay. I have to temper myself on this one. Go ahead.
Right. The subtag may be like why you need engagement and not wealth screening. I'm getting myself in trouble too. Cause I've friends at some prominent wealth screening firms. And we actually, even as a firm, have partnerships with some.
Sure.
But that's too. The we need more data myth. This actually came out of very large client, national, even a smidge international, and they were acknowledging a retention problem. And they decided against counsel that more data is what they needed to fix retention. And I'm still dumbfounded at what or how that does that, we'd actually kind of gone through and did some analysis on why there was a retention issue.
So let me make sure I get this correctly. So this is a client who has a major retention issue, and a lot of these organizations have that. And they go on an accumulation of data on those, on the same donors that they go collect a bunch of data on the donors that they've lost.
On the new ones. So they have great attraction. So they pick up new donors all the time. So like a celebrity endorsement type thing. So there's new sort of new blood all the time. So they got that down and are probably doing it better than, anybody I know actually.
Yes.
They're like, but month 8, month 9, and they get a lot of monthly recurring, evergreen type gifts out of it. But the problem is they sort of lose the green in month, 8, 9, and 10. So that's when their fall off start happening, month 9 in particular. And so they're like, well, how do we, we've brought these folks in, they stay, they're super excited in the beginning, we lose them then. And, and then the bottom line was we need more data. And I was like, yeah, fine.
To do what? What are they going to do with it?
I never got an answer on that because that's sort of what I was, the problem was more of a people and a process problem, not a.
To fill in more personalization fields in their form letters or what? I mean, what are they?
I mean, because that's what they are best at, is
Like some right. So, I've got a field now that's got the name of your dog in it now, and that's apparently going to convince you to give us a check.
Right. And I can segment my appeals and, I can start going straight into major gift asks for the folks that have, more capacity. Under some, second myth that capacity trumps propensity or something. I don't know. it's kind of a crazy thing. So, my bottom line is you hardly ever need more data, right? And I always think, especially from a major gift perspective, you know, your next major gift prospect is already in your database, and it's really more engagement. There's, you know, I can think of five more things that you need more than data, right? Like I think you need more stewardship, you know, and for me, stewardship is engagement. Engagement fixes retention. It's not hard, right? That again, that's not rocket science, but that takes work. Maybe that's the problem, you know? So I think you need more stewardship. You need more time. I don't know, like Market Smart, Greg Warner and his folks, they just released a study a little bit ago, a major gift benchmark study. It actually talked about the time of cultivation for major gifts. And it's pretty much, you know, like 1 to 2 years. Like 1 to 2 years was like 48% of the major gifts that were reported. It took 1 to 2 years to cultivate people for a major gift. Lots of 6 months to 12 months, another third. So, you know, which goes into, I know one of the things that you're very passionate about, like the whole turnover piece in our field. You know, if that's an issue and you're already acknowledging that it takes 1 to 2 years for 48% of the major gifts to happen, then you can see why the wheels start falling off the bus, right? You know, but so need more stewardship, need more time. You know, I think we need more golden rule. You know, I keep asking people when I see them do things, I'm like, well, like, would you want somebody to do that to you? Would you want them to send that to you? Would you want them to ask that of you, given what you know? And then they're like, oh, well, maybe not. And I'm like, well, okay, let's go back to, I don't know what that is. I don't know what that's going back to. When, or maybe we don't talk about the golden rule enough anymore. But, you know, if I don't want it to be done to me, somebody else probably doesn't want it to be done to them. And I probably shouldn't be doing it to somebody else if I don't want it. So more stewardship, more time, more golden rule. You know, we actually need more meetings and interactions. I think we do need that, you know, and we need more understanding and empathy. We need all those things before we need data. And actually, if you're doing those things right, you'll start getting actionable data. You know,
yeah,
the more you build a relationship, the more you get actionable data. So
one of the things we figured out. So when I was a gift officer in Washington, one of the things we figured out. So originally, my boss was just figuring out what it meant to employ gift officers. And I was a new gift officer at the time. And so when I originally came on, they had me doing a lot of the research and data gathering and well screening and so forth. Ahead of even picking up the telephone and engaging with the donor for the request for the first meeting. So these were generally current donors assumed to be of, you know, determined to be of some capacity, and obviously someone that we could presumably ask for more. But what Danielle and I figured out was that it was wiser and it was a better use of my time and the better use of data for me to actually reach out to the person, see if I could schedule the meeting, which didn't require a whole lot of information. And then only after that meeting was secured, then begin to do my homework in advance of that meeting.
Yes.
And that's awesome. That's what I learned to be. And I've said that a number of times in my seminar, is that we have to take this wealth screening stuff and this whatever data you're relying on, we have to put it in an appropriate sort of place in the process. Because I could spend all day long researching somebody, but if I can't get them to sit down and have lunch with me, for example, the data is not going to do me any good.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because that is so right on. Yeah, I have this. This is a little corny, so just forgive me. This is gonna, you know, this is way under, you know, the War for Fundraising Talent level of, you know, sophistication. But we talk about, like, you know, ability to give, affinity to your mission, and then access. Like, it's this AAA thing. Like, it's really, again, it's kind of corny, but. And that's whether we're doing like some, you know, major gift, like project capital campaign thing, or we're just doing sort of a major gift thing with existing folks that we know, you know, whether it's new folks or that, we want ability to give, affinity to the mission of the project, and then access. And that access thing is the thing, you know, so it's like sometimes, you know, it's the ability to get the appointment. And I think that's part of the engagement piece is like, let's see if they raise their hand at all, right? Like they raise their hand to wanting more relationship, to wanting more information on impact, to wanting all these other things that we could be offering before we would just ask them, you know? So I think that's spot on. You do the research after you've got the meeting is super helpful, you know, and that doesn't mean you're, you know, reaching out to everybody that gives you $20. I mean, there's got to be some sense to the thing based on scale and scope and staff, but.
So what's the, so we could have fun with that, but what's the, we've only got 12 minutes left. I generally don't like to keep our listeners and generally don't like to keep guys like you on here for more than about 40 minutes. So what's this third myth? I got to hear the third myth.
So this is actually coming out of a little bit of the COVID piece, and it's this myth that we can't live without our annual event. And I think maybe to the credit of, you know, our fellow consultants out there, you know, they're all, you don't have to do without it. We can like pivot, and that word's starting to drive. Is that driving you crazy? I don't want to hear pivot ever again. But anyway, right. So we can pivot and we can innovate. And I'm like, blah, 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 whatever. I'm still always like, let's refocus on major gifts. Let's like use this time. That's where I come from. But yeah, you know, so we can pivot, we can innovate, we can, you know, we can do things with Zoom and we can create these virtual things. And that's fantastic, you know, ish, you know, from my perspective.
Fantastic ish. Okay. I like that.
Yeah.
I'll think about how to use that word fantastic ish in the title. That's funny. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. So it's for me, it's the focus on major gifts. So like, that's great. You know, the reality, you know, annual events, kind of this is a really large range, but in my experience, like you either have folks that are sort of like netting anywhere between, you know, like 40 grand and like 400,000, right? Depending on the size of the thing, like a, sort of like just the very broad thing. And in most cases, and obviously whether you're at the 40,000 end of the spectrum or the $400,000 end of that spectrum, it probably depends on both your size and scope and staff, the same thing we just talked about, right? So if I've got enough size and scope and staff to generate an event that nets $400,000, I probably have enough size and scope and staff to generate enough major gifts to cover that, which would be a lot fewer, right? And then and the same with 40,000, you know, the work to get $40,000 in major gifts in any calendar year. I keep wanting to put this challenge out there and nobody will take me up on it. It's like, I can probably replace your net with a lot less work, you know, like it'll probably cost less and generate more is what I think on most annual events. And I think one of the things I was actually thinking about as it comes to like this whole special event thing, like special events tend to be, again, this could be an overstatement, but tend to be focused on like, you know, corporate participation. That's just always like a big focus, like the corporate underwriters and the big sponsors, you're selling tables and all that madness in my mind. And then you start, if you just took one step back and you're like, okay, well, where does money come from? And this is like a Giving USA thing, right? Like our friends at Giving USA. So where does money come from? We know that the bulk of money doesn't come from corporations, but we're so focused on this thing that may be all about money from corporations. Does that make sense? So I'm like, okay, let's do the hard work and let's focus on people again, you know, because again, Giving USA, this is only like 1-2% change over the last, you know, whatever, 10 plus years that we've looked at any of this data. So like, you know, bequests are always like 9 or 10%. Individuals are always like 68-70%. So you always have like roughly 80% of giving coming from living people and dead people, right? Living people and dead people give 80%. So why do we spend 80% of our time on this event that's after 5% of the giving, right? So that's just sort of my thing. I'm like, let's reapportion the time. Let's use it for major gifts from people, you know, individuals with skin, and go for it that way. And I think you can replace all of that money.
I don't think I have so much of an issue with events per se, because I think the thing, and you use the word, and I think this plays out in major gift fundraising the same way it does in event planning. And that is that we're doing too much selling. I think events are particularly guilty of this. I think we're selling people things. So in effect, we're having them behave like consumers and not generous people. And then similarly, I think we're doing this in major gifts. We're selling them too many things. We're putting their names on buildings. We're tying, you know, we're essentially having them buy oftentimes relatively intangible things, but they're still buying something in their mind. And so they're not experiencing what it means to be truly generous. And the best example I have, which does tie to events. So I was doing a feasibility study for a client in Texas, and I'm meeting with a grandparent couple. And in the meeting, I acknowledged some previous giving, a previous gift that they had given. I think they had only given one. according to my client's records. And the woman, the grandmother, she's a grandmother of a student at the private school, the independent school that I was working with. She says, "Oh, we've never given." And I'm looking at this record and I said, "No, there's $1,500 here." And so I'm asking for some clarification on this. Come to find out, she had literally bought a washer and dryer set at the annual auction. And in her mind, it was no different than her purchasing that washer and dryer at Sears.
Right.
And in the mind of my donors and what I had to, I mean, in the mind of my client, I had to, and this was a big conversation we had with my client, was that we get in this habit of selling people things that they never experience what it means to give generously anyway. And then when we actually need them to step up to the plate and do that, they've never done it for us to begin with. Right. My client, they had done their data research. Wealth Engine said these people could give us $1 million. Well, this person in their mind had never given the first gift because all they had done is bought a washer and dryer from the school.
Yeah, that's like a quid pro quo if there ever was one. This wasn't a gift.
Yeah, and I see that, and you know this. It plays out in major gift fundraising too. They buy things. A lot of times, it's naming opportunities and so forth. They put their names on bricks and everything else. And I think we owe it to humanity and to philanthropy and to our organizations not to sell our people things. And I think this is the challenge that we run into when it's ironic that so many people, and I would say a lot of these people tend to be the ones that get heavy, that are perfectly fine with event planning, but we don't like the notion that fundraising and looks anything like sales. And yet in many ways, that's all we're doing. Right. We're selling things like crazy. And I'm like, why don't you quit selling people, you know, everything from tote bags to naming opportunities, and actually ask them to give in a different side, you know, a different part of their brain that says, I don't have to get something in return for this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it reminds me, I actually had spent some time with someone who really came out of like the event side, and they were trying to transition into major gift side. And I couldn't get them to understand that like life change was enough. You know,
right.
they kept wanting to always like sell something or have a package. And I'm like, no, like, you know, here's the four areas of things that your organization does. And we have stories on each of these, and it's significant life change. So it should be enough. And maybe this is both, you know, the challenge to the folks in our profession as well as to folks that have means, right? So it's like, life change is the thing, right? That's what we're all about. So if I can make the life of a neighbor or a stranger better, that's the win. It isn't, you know, the whatever package, the whatever naming, the whatever thing that came with it. The thing is the world's a better place. It's exactly what you said. So I know that's it. It is sad that that's the case, but I think the more that's the beauty of major gifts, I think, especially outside of the context of a capital campaign. I mean, even in that context, we always say the naming opportunities augment gifts. They don't get gifts. And, you know, the exception is, you know, the super ego that's out there, right? The super ego, right. Maybe. But for the average person, you can use a naming opportunity to augment a gift, you know, to up a gift, not to necessarily secure the gift. But then, you know, we actually in January of this year, and we'll actually have a story about this soon generally, but we had a $2.5 million commitment to one campaign we're working on, and you know, the couple's anonymous, you know, so I'm like, that is so pure, you know, and it wasn't even a specific ask. It was a really general ask to be involved at a, you know, at a deep level. And they actually, you know, thought about it, and it took some time. And, you know, from the time the first conversation happened to the last was, you know, was 11 months. So maybe we didn't quite need the 1 to 2 years, but again, time, 11 months, super intentional, nothing rushed, no pressure, $2.5 million, all about life change, no recognition, you know, no nothing. So
yeah, I teach over at the local college, some a nonprofit in the nonprofit track, and I teach my students that, because I'm always trying to get my students to understand the difference that the nonprofit sector
plays in our world, in our economy, and you know, in our society, different than the government and different than the private sector. And like the way you're using the term life change, one of the things I say to my students is that each one of these sectors sort of relates to money differently. When we think of the private sector, we're usually buying and selling things. And when we think of the, you know, we think of the federal government or the local governments, we're thinking about subsidizing and, you know, being taxed and subsidizing things. And when we think about philanthropy and generosity and giving and fundraising, we're talking about looking at learning how to look at our money differently, giving it generously and being grateful for it when somebody gives it to us. And I don't think that if we hinge our, this is what sort of I think is very precarious and puts us in a messy predicament in the nonprofit sector. When we allow money to sort of behave itself, or when we behave in ways that more resemble the other two, our perception of money should not be consistent. In my mind, should not be identical to that of the private sector, or to be that of like the government. Because if it was, then we could just be them, and we're not. You know, I think we should have a different way of looking at money, and looking at money differently is the same thing I would, like you're calling, life change. Changing our perception. I'm trying to think of which one I think is the more sort of powerful myth. I still go back to because it's obviously a soapbox of mine. I still think that the first one is probably the one that I think is the most problematic right now, because I think what we're getting at, and I think this is the conversation you and I had offline when we talked the first time, is the first myth is this notion of discernment, or requires a certain degree of discernment. Where are we teaching that frontline fundraiser who's routinely interacting with donors to learn how to sort of discern the timeliness and appropriateness of the gift? And doesn't that sort of weave into the second one, which is the, you know, where data is helpful and where it's not, and whether an event is appropriate or not?
Exactly. They are related for sure. Now, I love the idea of discernment. I think that's actually clearer. We've talked a lot about all of this has intentionality wrapped in it. Like, I don't like when my clients are trying to do something that's reactionary. You know, let's try to be intentional. There's always, you know, surprises, but let's try to be intentional. But whenever you're being intentional, especially as you start getting to major gifts, there's a tension, you know, like intentionality requires, you know, living in that tension of always being aware, always being empathetic, always knowing when it's, you know, okay to ask, when it's optimum to ask, and when it's good for the donor for you to ask versus not, you know. So it's, discernment is what that's all about, because you can't just like steamroll into a, you know, into a meeting and go through your agenda without, you know, listening, you know, and paying attention. And
you use the word tension. Is that essentially what all three are guilty of, is avoiding that tension? Is that essentially what we're getting at? Because in the first one, I think we've got advisors that are basically avoiding the tension of asking a question that, you know, has to actually require us to think a little bit, and we can't do it in, you know, 2-minute sound bites. That's why you're so fond, and it's why we have found so much joy in doing major gift work, because we can settle into that ambiguity and unpredictableness and tension of that moment of not knowing exactly where this is going to go.
Right.
And then at the same time, being relatively confident based on our experiences that, yeah, this will probably go somewhere soon enough.
Right. And very positive, you know, more likely than not. Or wouldn't be sitting there to begin with, you know. So that's the beauty of it. That's exactly right. I think the tension, maybe it's the tension avoidance that maybe that's the greatest ill that's driving a lot of these. Yeah, because that's even with events. Like, so I should probably not sound like I am completely anti-event. I actually love the idea of events as entry points. I don't love the idea of events as like carrying my budget. You know, that's where I am. That's where.
How would you put the? How would you? So we'll have an exploratory wrap up thought here. How would you put the tension that we're referring to? How would you put ambiguity and tension and unpredictableness in back into an event, for example?
So
what would that look like?
I do it on the. It's activity on the back end that takes attention on the front end. So I actually just did this in the fall. So with a development director, you know, client. So planning this event, it was like a second annual big event. You know, the bosses, I'm using air quotes that you can't see on a podcast. The bosses wanted to do the big gala thing. And I was like, Fine, if we have to do this, let's do it this way. It's going to be fine. We're going to raise money for these things. We're going to tell our story. We're going to tell the story of the life change piece. But I said, from my perspective, for you, you know, newer development person, if you can't, you know, after this event, know who like the top 5 to 10 people that you can actually have a meaningful, rich follow-up relationship building time with, then it's a waste. So I want you to know, like in the invitation piece, I want you to be, you know, even if you have to comp the ticket, and then that's like terrible, right? Like, it's, I don't know. There's people that won't like that. Even if you have to comp the ticket to get the person there that you think is the person that has this capacity, propensity thing, both, not just capacity, like get them there so you can follow up with them. And so that's sort of been my thing. Like, let's have the event, but I want you to think on the front end, who are the 5 to 10 people that you're going to actually go deep with? And you're going to use this event as one of the pieces of their cultivation to go deep. So for me, that's that. And because that does require some attention and some different, you know, there's like tension in the moment, there's tension in the planning, and it's not just this event knock list, right? It's like, okay, here's these 5 to 10 people. Those are actually my priority for this thing, not the, you know, the cattle call that is the event. So.
Yeah, it'd be, we could, you're almost like, I think implicit in what we're talking about, this last exploratory idea, totally shooting from the hip here. It's like the event that knows it has a goal, but it hasn't defined what that goal is. Or allowing serendipity to sort of show up at that event. So it's like kind of, it's the idea of how can you organize an event and get a lot of people in the room and actually be surprised at what the outcomes are. Right. Instead of having this event that's very, you know, predictable in terms of it orchestrating, you know, let's say the goal is to raise $100,000. You know, if we raise 80, we're disappointed. If we raise 120, you know, in some ways we get sort of weary of that, you know, even sometimes, because that sort of loses it just starts to feel very manufactured, even when it's completely successful.
Well, and then if we've never had any true engagement with people other than that one time a year thing, I don't know what the point is. Like, I truly don't know.
Right.
Like,
well, you can't without that engagement. And that's why, again, that's why you keep saying you're a major gifts guy, myself included, is when you get to the lunch table, you actually create those serendipitous moments where you, sure, I'm going to ask you for $25,000. Sure, I'm probably going to get it. But this relationship may go somewhere else too. And I don't know where that is. And my guess is that it'll be pretty cool.
Right.
Sure. I think that's what we miss out on when we're not engaging with people in meaningful ways. And it's that tension that sort of scares us away. David, you got me stirred up. I hope you got a couple of our listeners stirred up too. You're always welcome back, but if somebody wants to follow up on these thoughts with you, they know how to find me. How would they find you?
Yeah. So our firm's Giving Design. So givingdesign.com and pretty much anything out there in the virtual world that is Giving Design is us. And there's a contact form there. Feel free to, you know, reach out, shout out. Love to get to know anyone who's interested in any of these things. So yeah, givingdesign.com.
And where, and what sort of scope of services, and where you, all over the country, all over the planet, where do you, I have to imagine you could probably be servicing a client, in my neighborhood here on the East Coast, but you could always probably be doing that in another part of the world as well, right?
Yeah, we're actually engaged coast to coast right this second. So you know, okay. We're doing stuff here in California, Sacramento, down here in LA, and then also We do a lot in the Southeast. So we're, you know, doing stuff in Atlanta, multiple clients, South Carolina, kind of all over the place. We've done things everywhere in between, you know, Arkansas, Utah, Colorado, cool. Tennessee.
We
equal opportunity airplane jump honor.
Right, right. Well, we will definitely, you've definitely been a thought provoking guest, and we will definitely put some information about Giving Design in the show notes. And thank you again, my friend.
It was my pleasure. I appreciate it so much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.